Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Denise Michaud, Chair of the Club's Grownups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our program tonight is Index Funds, Launching the Revolution of Modern Investing. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers. John Mack McQuown is a financial engineer, entrepreneur, and environmentalist. After earning his MBA from Harvard Business School in 1961, he worked on Wall Street and was disturbed at how much subjectivity went into investment management. He later joined Wells Fargo, founded and led their management sciences group, where he pioneered the use of data analysis to create the first equity index fund and launched a revolution in investing. Since then, Mac has co-founded several successful ventures, including Dimensional Fund Advisors, $600 billion under management, Diversified Credit Investments, Visa Advisors, also known as eBond Advisors. In 2017, Mac was awarded the Innovation Award for Pioneering Index Funds by CME Group. A longtime collector of fine wines, he co-founded Stone Edge Farm Estate Vineyards and Winery in Sonoma, California, with his wife, Leslie. And as a dedicated environmentalist with a desire to combat climate change, Mac is leading his farm towards energy self-sufficiency. He also serves on the Advisory Council of Scripps Oceanography at UC San Diego. Rick Rabin brings over 40 years of experience in finance. He started his career as a CPA, later serving as chief financial officer for Rosenberg Real Estate Equity Funds. He helped found and served as the first president of the National Council of Real Estate Investment Fiduciaries, which publishes a series of indexes on the investment performances of real estate. In 2006, he founded Lifetime Capital Group, where he helps his clients apply scientific, evidence-based investing to their personal needs. And a couple of years ago, Rick published his book, Investing 3.0, What the Creators of Index Funds Discovered and How to Profit from It. Please welcome Mac and Rick.
Thank you. Among the most important inventions in the last 50 years are index funds. When you combine them with the discount brokerage fees and the reduction no commission mutual funds, they've really turned the table on Wall Street so that investors can get what they were was always promised but rarely delivered, which is market returns. And so what you'll hear this evening is a unique perspective on modern investing, starting with the development of index funds. It starts with the story of a curious Illinois farm boy who became a mechanical engineer before earning a Harvard MBA. It'll feature very slow IBM mainframe computers and a pile of academic research that challenged the status quo. They found that humans seldom beat the market, which was heresy at the time. This led to a big data experiment that would change finance forever, and earn more than a handful of Nobel Prizes, and created enormous wealth and understanding for investors all over the world. As important as index funds are, they're only part of the story. Tonight, you'll hear about what has evolved since index funds were introduced almost 50 years ago. And maybe you'll get a glimpse into what's coming soon. So without further delay, let me introduce you to the star of our story, John Mack McQuown. So Mack, maybe you can just start us off and tell us a little bit about yourself and background, what caused you to pursue a career in investing?
Well, as you said, I'm a farm boy. And I mean that both affectionately and literally. And so my early years were in Illinois, but I think the thing that turned the tide for me was having to deal with so much equipment. We were corn farmers and oats and alfalfa, et cetera, and it required a lot of equipment. And so who was driving the machines and repairing the machines? My uncle and the hired man, and I was working with them. And I started when I was 8, and I did that until I was 18. So by the time I went off to college, guess what? I was interested in mechanics. So I studied mechanical engineering. And I was naval ROTC, because I would have been drafted in the Korean fracas if it hadn't been for that. So my whole 5 years in engineering school was taken up by engineering courses plus naval science. So I never had an opportunity to study anything except those two topics. So I spent 2 years in the Navy, and guess what? I was the engineering officer on a destroyer out of San Diego. So by that time, I'd gotten schmitten with finance. When a fraternity brother of mine had gone to Harvard, and he had been out for several years and was working at a big bank in Chicago, Harris Trust. And he persuaded me that I should go to Harvard to study finance. Now, in those days, there was no analytical finance at all. Today, you would go to Chicago to study that stuff. You wouldn't go to Harvard. So I went to Harvard, and what I learned was enough to get me a job on Wall Street, although it was pretty entertaining when I was interviewed by one Wall Street firm. He looks at my resume, and he says, why would an engineer want to go to Wall Street? That was a damn good question in those days. Now about two-thirds of everybody.
Everybody's a rocket scientist now. Yeah.
But anyway, what I discovered when I got there, much as Rick was just saying, that all the portfolio construction was more or less by Kentucky Windage. Remember what that is, right? And that didn't make any sense to me. And especially because we were just at the time coming in to the fore with data. The Center for Research and Securities Prices had been started just about the same time. And they had data on the New York Stock Exchange from 1926 to 1960. I think it was 1,200 stocks, monthly data initially. And then next thing, there was not monthly, but weekly, and it wasn't long before it was daily, and it wasn't long before it also included Tokyo and EMEA, Europe, East and Middle East and Africa, all the major exchanges in the world. And so all of a sudden we went from having one market to, 40 different markets. So various hypotheses that we were interested in entertaining on the New York data, we were able to entertain at all kinds of other locations. Well, about the same time I got interested in all that, I bumped into Ransom Cook, who was the chairman of Wells, at a meeting down at IBM down at San Jose Executive Center. I was asked to give a talk down there, and Ransom was in the audience. So Ransom invited me to his office on California and Montgomery, and he wanted to know what I was doing in New York. And I was going to school, and I was collecting data and testing hypotheses and trying to earn a living on Wall Street all at the same time. And my wife was in graduate school at Columbia. He said, I think you should drop all that and come work for me. And he was pretty persistent. So a couple weeks later, he made me an offer, and I persuaded my then wife that we should move to San Francisco, and we did. That was in March of 64. So, as they say, the rest is history. But what happened, crucially, was I met Gene Fama and Jim Lurie and Larry Fisher at the University of Chicago. And I met them at a meeting that was arranged by a mutual friend at Merrill Lynch, who had put up the money to build the original CRISP data. And Lurie and Fisher, I asked Jim if he could give me an explanation of why the returns on common stock did not follow a normal probability distribution. It doesn't look like a normal distribution. It's got real fat tails. And he said, I can't tell you, but I know somebody who can. He's my student, Gene Fama. So I went to Chicago in 63 and met Gene. And an hour later, met Merton Miller. And with that, my relationship with the whole pile of professors and students at Chicago took off. And, of course, that in combination with Wells Fargo's willingness to spend money.
Yeah.
And so we started developing all this stuff, and I met that guy, raised his hand, Wayne. And he left IBM to come work with me back in those days, and we went after the subject.
And he was your first hire for your team?
I'm not sure he was the first, but he was in number one. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe. And Dave Basenfelder, where's Dave? He was another hire.
Oh, okay. But going back, when you were at Harvard, we talked about earlier, they weren't talking about the quantitative stuff that you were interested in. So how'd you go about getting connected with that?
Well, one of my classmates knew I was interested in this topic, and he had met a professor at MIT, which is, of course, just across the river. And so I met that professor, and he was collecting data. He was actually trying to put a blade on what the returns to common stocks actually were.
And that was the first that people were doing that, because you said Kentucky Windage.
Well, that was before the CRISP file came on stream. He had a database. It was only about 500 or 600 stocks. But it was enough of a database. That was about a 20-year time series. And that was enough to get a rough understanding of what the distribution
was. It was the first of trying to understand.
That was the first data set that I was messing with.
So you were one of the early pioneers of applying computer
science. He was the pioneer. I was writing code. I was just working for him.
But compared to what Wall Street was doing,
they were
way
doing
ahead of the game.
They weren't doing anything, yeah. No.
And so that, you know, from that, when you were on Wall Street, you continued to work with him then.
I did, yeah, for a goodly number of years, actually.
And so through that, what happened with you? What was the story about the slow computer, and how did that lead to your being in San Jose?
Well, there were two sets of problems. One was we were getting more and more data, and we had 7090s, IBM 7090s. Remember, Wayne? 7090s and 7094s, they were solid-state machines finally, and they were quite a bit faster. But we got more and more and more data, and we were having all kinds of difficulty estimating some of these functions. So the guys who were putting up the money were willing to spend the money, and I made a deal with IBM to rent entire shift, 8-hour shift on a 7094 in the Time Life building at 51st and 6th Avenue. So I would, and what shift do you suppose it was? Right. Yeah, right. So I would take my sleeping bag and get the thing started, and when the computer stopped, it would wake me up. You think I'm kidding? I'm not kidding. And it made a lot of noise in those days. So that's how we did it.
And so IBM knew about you doing that.
Yeah, and they invited me to give that talk at San Jose.
And so because part of what they were trying to do is help their bank clients figure out how to do more than just accounting statements with their computers.
Well, that was what Ransom Cook said to me. He said, you know, we're spending more and more and more money on computers, and we're doing the same things we were doing in the 1930s with armbands and green eye shades. We got to be able to do more than that. And, of course, that's correct, but you got to have data, and you got to understand the kinds of investigations you need to pursue. So that if anybody was really willing to spend money on a whim, it was Ransom Cook and Dick Cooley. That would never have happened if those two guys hadn't been willing to spend that kind of money, right? And we had, how big a group did we have in management sciences in the final analysis? 30 people or something like that?
More.
Yeah, or even more. And how many consultants?
More.
Yeah. And we had, and six of those consultants subsequently won Nobel Prizes. So, you know, a very, very major line of inquiry that ended up having an influence on academia, not just the other way around, right?
Yeah, groundbreaking for what it was.
It was groundbreaking, right. I think one of the really most interesting things was Dick Cooley, who was then the CEO, had been interested in a collaborative adventure with Nikko Bank in Japan, and there was a database being built by Nikko. And he said to me, do you suppose we could use that data to try to figure out whether that we'd get the same kinds of results? And I said, absolutely. So I went off to Tokyo and made a deal with Nikko and got the data and bring it back. And we ran that kind of data through the same models, and what kind of results did we get? Exactly the same. So it was increasingly clear that it wasn't just an isolated example of what we were. And what did we find, by the way? Share prices follow a random walk. There's no trend. Well, there is a trend in them, but you got to have to work hard to find the trend. After that, there's nothing. And that's because the observations are sequentially independent. The probability of the next price being higher or lower than tonight's price is exactly 50-50. So there, you can push that out quite a ways, and you can take it into, you know, from hour to hour, or you can push it out from year to year, and you more or less get the same thing. Now, if you go out to 10 years, you find trend. But by far and away, there isn't any sequential interest in the data. It's just the observations are sequentially independent.
So that makes it really hard for that kind of active management that Wall Street is built on.
Yeah, it kind of says that active management, you should be pretty suspicious of it. You got to know something more that's in share prices. But if knowledge creates share prices, how can you know more than is already embedded in share prices? That's a contradiction, right? And a lot of people in those days were not happy with that inference, right?
Yeah, but you weren't the only one who had this idea. You had the professor at MIT you worked with, but then you got out to the University of Chicago, and you met others that are similar.
Well,
ideas.
I mean, you know, and then of course Bill Sharp,
out here
from Stanford, and Bart Rosenberg at Berkeley, and Burton Malkiel from Princeton. But, you know, it was a smattering of people. The epicenter of it was at Chicago, and it revolved around Merton Miller, who was really kind of the intellectual dean of the whole analytical movement.
Okay. But so you found that. And so when you got to Wells Fargo, what did you were brought in by Ransom Cook. What was your assignment? What did he want? What was your role? What did he tell you to do?
Ransom was interested in the idea that see, the way he put it was as follows. The bank of the future cannot survive on loans and deposits alone. They're going to have to be in the investment business. If they're in the investment business, they're going to have to be in the retail investment business, not just the wholesale investment business. So we're going to have strategies that work for retail. They're going to have to be simple and robust. Now, about the same time, Citibank was working on distributing mutual funds, and they got shut down from doing that by a Supreme Court decision. So the banks that were selling mutual funds were deemed to be in violation of Glass-Steagall, which was the separation of church and state, right? The banks were over here, and the investment banks were over here, investment banks and brokers, and they put a wall between those two sets of institutions. So they shut it down. So Ransom, of course, Walt Wriston was the head of Citibank at the time, and they were very good friends. So the question was, how are we going to deal with this problem? Well, what we decided to do was to go sell it to institutions first.
The big pension funds.
So that's what we did, and we turned it into we never lost sight of the fact that Ransom was right about getting it to the retail investment public, right? And he was dead on right about that topic.
Yeah, but before you could start selling, you'd have something you could sell.
That's right.
And so when you were brought in to start working on this, you started to assemble a team. Who were you connecting with, and what were you really looking for in the people you were trying to hire, or that you were hiring?
Well, intelligent, curious, and analytical, and not afraid to deal with data, because we were really a data shop.
Okay. And that's different from what you were seeing on Wall Street in general.
Well, there wasn't any of the above on Wall Street. That was... In fact, you might even ask whether there is now.
Well, they do in different
ways. Of course there is, but I'm kind of joking on that point. But in those days, it wasn't a joke, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting that all of this started in San Francisco at Wells Fargo. It didn't start in New York. Where was the epicenter of the investment management enterprise in America? It was in New York, right? It wasn't San Francisco. but because of Ransom and Dick, I mean, it got started at Wells Fargo.
And your culture was really the data-driven, the analytical, not as the Wall Street selling product type.
Analytical.
Very analytical. And so
data-driven.
And that was a different culture to create than what you were seeing elsewhere.
Absolutely different. Yeah. So needless to say, he had to insulate us from the investment management side of Wells.
A little political aspects to it.
And that was not so easy in the beginning because there was a lot of animosity. But, I'll have to give those guys credit. In the final analysis, we shared all the data and conclusions we got with the investment side, and they actually came around. I mean, Jim Furton, who was a staunch enemy of the idea at the very beginning, and the final analysis became one of the staunchest devotees of the conclusions that we were reaching, namely that you've got to create basically index funds. But more generally, you've got to create factors.
But you didn't even know at the time when you're starting out that there was such a thing as an index fund. So many of the research you were doing, did you even know? I mean, did you go down blind alleys as you were looking for figuring out what a solution was?
Yes. Yes. Well, first of all, it's pretty obvious that the Dow 30 was the big index at the time, right? 30 stocks. And the S&P 500 has 500 stocks. Can you surmise that there's a diversification difference between those two things? Mm-hmm. Especially the way this one is constructed versus the way this is constructed. Mm-hmm. It's constructed by human beings with criteria, right? And if you substituted one name in the Dow 30, you could screw up all kinds of things. You change a name in the S&P 500. So yes, we began looking at indexes, but we constructed all of our own indexes. We just took the market, regardless of whether it was traded in New York, over the counter, NASDAQ, or American, sorted them from the biggest companies to the smallest companies, took the top 1,000, the next 1,000, the next 1,000, the next 1,000, sort of the Russell strategy of today, right?
Right.
And we looked at the performance of those things, those groups, actually in quintiles. Differences showed up right away. And it was a non-trivial issue because, first of all, not very much of that data had ever been pawed over to that degree of refinement.
Right.
It was an awful lot of quality control issue having to do with all that data. I mean, one of the biggest tasks we ever had was to get that data as accurate as possible. And also, when you start going from monthly to weekly to daily, just think about how much more data you're talking about. And just when we went to the first section of the Tokyo Exchange, 600 stocks, I mean, all of a sudden, we got an awful lot more data, and we're trying to get more time series to see what's going on through the passage of time. So, no kidding, this became a big data-driven job, to say the least. I don't think there was any place in America that was doing anything like that kind of data.
Well, you're pioneering on that analysis, but there's another thing then to take that and put that into a workable portfolio.
Yes, of course.
Because you're trying to systematize the investment process, right?
Well, one of the problems with that, of course, is transactions costs.
Yeah.
Right? You got to buy these stocks.
Especially
back then is right. See, you can buy all these stocks today on a computer, right? Not then. You can get out of the way of the broker, but you couldn't get out of the way of the market maker. Whereas today, that's more or less gone, both. So the long and the short of it, in those days, if you turn over a portfolio, your transactions cost could cost you 5%, 6%, 7%, 8%, 9%, 10% for one turn. And today, you could turn a portfolio for practically nothing, a few basis points. But the game was very different in those days.
Right. But so you were working through trying to understand how to do that, and finally you brought in different consultants along the way. And
the consultants were what we crucially depended upon.
Right.
We were just working, but I mean there were, I mean you know, Bill Sharp. I mean, some of you will know some of these names, right? Myron Scholes, Fisher Black, Harry Markowitz, Bill Sharp, Barr Rosenberg. I mean, these are the brightest guys you could find.
So Markowitz was the author of the Modern Portfolio Theory.
Right.
He did his PhD on.
University of Chicago, 1952.
Key pricing model, what they call the capital asset pricing model,
yep,
which is how they put things together. Then you had Gene Fama, who was the efficient market, about how the market reflects all information available. And so those are key players. But then you also, Fisher Black and Myron Scholes did what's known as the Black-Scholes options pricing model, and that's what they won their Nobel Prize. So they brought all these people together. And we're all elements. Now, in 68, you had been doing this research, but rather than around here, Silicon Valley, everyone keeps everything really tight and proprietary, and you have all these non-disclosure agreements and everything else. You went the other way. You published. What was your thinking behind publishing all your research and how to do that?
Well, as the old saying goes, a funny thing happened on the way to the forum. How in the hell are you ever going to keep that stuff under cloaks? You really can't. And especially if you're hiring academics who have to make a living doing research and publishing papers. So to some degree, if you're going to get the brains you need to do the job, you're also going to have to deal with the implications of public disclosure. So we just basically... We bit that bullet and we just let it go completely open. And our idea was to just have better analytics and more data, and that's what we did. The closest financial institution around at the time that was doing anything similar was Bankers Trust in New York. They were by far the closest one. I would say they were really the only one. And do you suppose we knew those guys? Of course we knew those guys, right? There's a very small world out there. So in the final analysis, we just let it fly.
And then you thought you could out-execute and create what you were doing.
The key was turning it into products.
Turning it into products. And you're the first
to
do that.
And I go right back to Ransom and Dick on that. I mean, it would have been very few banks that were willing to put their neck out that far. I mean, there's fiduciary responsibility in that picture, right? And there's responsibility for how do you actually train an organization to sell that kind of stuff? I mean, it's you don't really sell it; you deliver it, right? You have to sing the song and dance the dance. But when that's over, it's all delivery.
So along came Samsonite,
and then along came that's right. Keith Schrader was the son of the Schrader family, who did his PhD at Chicago, and we met him through Jim Laurie, who was one of the important professors at Chicago. And he was really interested in the idea of having a robust investment strategy for the Samsonite Pension Fund. And so, in the final analysis, we took a chunk of their pension fund. I think it was $5 million, some number like that. Six, huh? And we took some, and we talked, well, and then the Wells guys decided they should do it for their Wells pension fund, too, about the same time. And how much was that? Another five or six or something. So the long and the short of it is we ended up with two of them in pretty short order. And that began to get people's attention.
Yeah.
Because remember, this is all open, right?
So you did that, and then... So that was the beginning of index funds.
Yep.
So one of the things that I think many of us, I know when I started doing my research that led to this, is the confusion about what John Bogle was doing at Vanguard and the whether or not that's where index funds are started. So, but you helped John get his first fund launched. What's the story behind that?
We did. Well, remember what I said about... Wells Fargo and Citibank being frozen out of distribution in the retail market because of violation of Glass-Steagall. Well, our lawyer, I mean, you can't even believe that today, right? That was another piece of idiocy coming out of Washington. Proof positive they didn't know what they were doing. But anyway, so what Dick Cooley said, look, if Jack Bogle is interested in the retail market, let's help him. We'll break the barrier down by helping somebody do it that can do it, because he was on the investment banking side, right, on the broker dealer side of the puzzle. So when I said to him, how are we going to get compensated for it? He says, don't worry about getting compensated for it. Just show him how to do it. Well, he was already thinking about it. So we went to Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and gave him the results of our work, gave it to him. And that's where the S&P 500 fund came out of, the Vanguard S&P 500 fund came out of that.
And his was the first mutual fund for individual investors.
Mutual fund for individual investors.
So that's the nuanced difference between the two. But your technology is what he really built that on.
That's right.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Learn about our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for any of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now back to our program.
Now, a lot's gone on since you first did that. With all the advances that have occurred, are conditions now such that individual investors can actually, by doing forecasting and other active management, outperform? Has that changed the dynamic between indexing and or passive investing and active management?
Well, it's axiomatic to say that if you have more or different information than the market has, you ought to be able to profit by it. The question is whether you really do have information that's not already in the market. How would you like to go about proving that you have information that's not already in the market? What would restrict the world of development of knowledge such that I was the one who had it and nobody else did? That doesn't seem like a very likely prospect, does it? Well, on the other side of the coin, what we're talking about index funds, we're really talking about a market factor. Index is an index of the whole market, but you can have an index of anything, right? So all of that, out of that came what we began to say as risk factors. So one of the big ones was small cap stocks.
That came after you left Wells Fargo.
We did work on small caps from Wells days. That's where David got the idea, right?
Oh, okay.
That's where it fundamentally came from. But I mean, David and the people at Dimensional were the ones who pushed it to its logical conclusion and turned it into actual product, right? The micro cap fund that Dimensional started in 1981, but the roots of that research were at Wells.
But the technology you do with indexing doesn't really lend itself to going after some of the areas of the market like small caps where the trading gets to be very expensive.
You have to develop your own factors, basically, the way I like to think about it. You have to create your own frame of reference. And then you convince a client you have an index. Here's the way we complete the index, and here's the actual fund that corresponds to the index. We have to pay the price of getting buying and selling investments to get it into an actual fund. This is just numbers, smashing numbers together. So the question is, how close can we get the performance of the actual portfolio to the index? Now, we did an awful lot of work on that subject for quite a while, too. And then the question is, What are small caps? Well, that's just the smallest 10% of the market, or maybe the smallest 20. What about the middle quintile or the middle fractile? What fraction do you want? How much diversification do you want? Why limit it to the New York? Why not just combine the NASDAQ, the New York, and the American? Why should you worry about those differences?
But as you started to look at going into factors, you have indexing and index funds that are built around just trying to replicate somebody's stated index and how you trade to track that.
Yep.
But when you start getting into other areas like the factor funds where you're going into parts of the market that aren't as deeply traded. We
had to create all that ourselves.
Yeah, and so that creates, so the indexing technology actually didn't, you had to go to another generation, building on the framework that your academics had helped you establish, but taking it, implementing it a little differently.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
And so that's really what the beginnings of Dimensional Fund Advisors, what you did at DFA.
That's right.
And why don't we talk a little bit about what some of those innovations were that you had to do that really is the next level. I call it 3.0. You've called it second generation indexing. But what are the kind of key distinctions there?
Well, the crucial thing that you got to get is that so now we start to buy and sell small cap stocks. How much information do I have when I'm a passive investor in a given company? I don't have any information at all. Zero. So who's selling me the stock? Well, in principle, it could be somebody with some information about that company, right? They either want to own it or they want to get rid of it because they know something that I don't know. So we become a target of their gaming. So we got to develop strategies for trading that insulate us from those who have information that we don't have. So developing those methods of trading where we was really Fisher Black more than any other one individual, though Myron was deeply involved in that too.
Okay.
And that's a really crucial part of it. And I think at Dimensional we've really perfected that idea. That we can construct portfolios of things without moving the market at all, and we do all kinds of work to measure that effect. Right. When you start trading, you don't want to move a market. Right. By that I mean you don't want to move an individual stock.
Well, you hear that a lot. One of the knocks about mutual funds is when they have to move large blocks, how it can really affect the price. And so one of the things that you, from the very beginning, when you started looking beyond the index fund design itself, how to improve on it, was how to avoid that issue.
That's right. That's right. So, I mean, there's a whole litany of thinking and a new set of practices that have to evolve out of that set of ideas.
Yeah, and so you were low block, you were waiting for people really to come to you so they'd be going
across. Yeah, that's the key. What you do is you buy what people want to sell, and then you figure out what fractions of a given portfolio should be in that particular offering that particular position, and you build positions little by little, and they're all out of balance all the time. But if you got enough, if you have 1,000 names, the individual name differences versus what you really want are not going to matter very much, provided you buy them at the right price.
So that's one of the key characteristics of how you balance that together.
That's how we developed the means of doing that. And so we do that now. I mean, we measure our transactions costs at Dimensional. Like, you know, we measure that stuff like crazy. I mean, our transactions costs are negligible.
So when you started index funds, the only pricing model that was around at the time was the one market one with the capital asset pricing model. Since then, since the 70s, we've evolved to say that there are other factors. So the smaller stocks are looked at as generating over the long term higher returns. They call that premiums. Value stocks, companies that aren't considered to be necessarily the big stars, they end up having to pay more for their capital, which means it's a higher return for investors. And most recently, you've looked at holding other things constant, the profitability or cash flow within a company. And so that's one of the things that the platform today allows for these continued research and further refinements. How does that work?
Well, it works by fits and starts. You have to think through what it is you're trying to accomplish and how you're going to go about acting in a market where people have information that you don't have, no matter what it is you're doing, right? A lot of work was done by Gene Fama, what's called the five factor model originally. One of the really interesting factors that we still don't really have a handle on, in my opinion, is the default probability of a given company's debt, which is a measure of the relationship between the riskiness of a company's assets and how much leverage they have. Because the product of the riskiness at the asset level times the leverage gets you the riskiness of the debt, right? But the question is whether the pricing on the equity market and the pricing in the bond market are synchronized to such a degree that there's no disparity between the implicit risk forecast in the equity and the explicit risk forecast in the bond. You follow that logic? So the question is, how do you arbitrage those two things, or how do you use that differential to decide what to buy or what not to buy? So that's one of the key ways we've gone about doing
it. I think it's complicated.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, one of the things that's going on in the market today is there are a lot of new products and a lot of talk about different factors and other ways to split that. And it seems that the testing you're doing is trying to – how do you keep that simple enough to manage? And a lot of these kind of overlapped, and some can be explained by others. So is there kind of a key limit to how far you go with the sense of precision with these different factors?
Not that I've discovered so far.
You keep liking to go to more factors?
Well, we can explain the risk premium in equities with five factors. If you start looking at the same problem in corporate credit, you need about 25 factors. And the question is whether you can get differentiation between factor 23 and factor 24.
They're diminishing returns on adding more complexity.
And the answer, of course, depends on how much data you've got, as well as whether there's anything there in the first place. If there's not there anything there in the first place, they don't care how much data you got, you can't find the difference, right?
So in the equity side, when they went from the single factor, which explained like 70% of the return,
yeah,
to now where
well,
they have...
maybe not 70, but half, two-thirds.
Two-thirds. And now up to when they have the four or five factors...
You can get up to about 95%.
So there's a big gain from that, but going any further, you really have...
Yeah, most of the last 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8% is really noise. We can't figure out what it is. It's just unexplained variance. But I mean, you know, maybe there'll be a day when we understand that. But when it comes to default options and the pricing of default options, now you're talking about way more complicated problem. Way, way, way more. As I said, you know, 20 or 25 factors, we can get significant. We can measure significance with respect to. I mean that's a lot of things, right? And, you know, it raises questions about just how good regression analysis is in the first place. And, of course, the answer is it's not that good. Why isn't it not that good? Well, it's predicated predominantly on assumptions about normality. And you got to be very careful about that because those distributions, I'm telling you, are not normal.
Yes.
So you got to be super cautious about what you're doing. Yeah, so now we're getting into super sophisticated mathematical statistics relative to where we started. I mean, so 50 years ago, we were using pretty simple things. I mean, today it's ridiculous stuff. I don't even understand it.
Yeah. Well, if you don't, we're in trouble.
Well, I don't know about that.
So, but one of the key elements that to me, we still have the contrast between what your team and all do, how they approach it versus Wall Street. How would you describe that culture? What's the key to that?
Well, learning how to be in love with uncertainty. What can I say? I mean, you gotta like not understanding, and you gotta like pressing forward no matter what you haven't yet figured out.
But the thing that we've talked about is, you know, pursuit of the knowledge, really the understanding, and being true to that is one of the core values that you have, and that has really been a hallmark of your team and people that you've brought in. Everyone's really been committed rather than taking shortcuts or trying to otherwise come up with something they could just sell.
Well, when you stop and think about my years at Harvard, where there were no computers and no data, and it was all Kentucky windage, versus today, where it's all data and all modeling. And, you know, there's way, I mean, you know, the places are full of mathematicians and statisticians, right? Yes, we have microeconomists, but what about macroeconomists? Forget it. I mean, you can't figure those things out. I mean, national income statistics, for all intents and purposes, you can forget. They're not analytically tractable. You got to get down into the microcosm, and when you do, what you find is national income account doesn't tell you anything. So we've gone from Kuznets in the 20s to there weren't any computers in the 1920s. Well, there were, but they weren't. We wouldn't call them computers today. We really didn't get computers until we got solid state machines. Right, we're talking about in the 60s. We had analog computers aboard the destroyer that I was on. That was a computer, but man, you wouldn't want to think about it in the same sense we're discussing data here. So you're only talking about 40 or 50 years ago that we really had computers that were functioning and enough data. And so it's just become this massive data and tasking, right?
Well, in understanding what a sufficient data set is, that you have enough observations to draw meaningful conclusions.
You never have enough observations.
Well, I mean, that's one of the. I mean, that's what your goal and you're striving for is trying to have. You're dealing with levels of credibility as you're doing that, as opposed to some of the other things that you see out in the marketplace where people take a very small data set and say they can draw these grand conclusions that are at odds with what the main findings are.
Well, don't forget another thing, too. While all of this analytical work is going on, who are we going to sell these new products to? Pension funds? Guess what? Do you think they've gotten sophisticated? Whoa. I mean, there was a time when, the universities weren't pumping out enough graduate students with enough know-how on these things to populate the Fortune 100. To say nothing of 1,000 pension funds. I mean, now, of course, the story is really different. I mean, now there's a half a dozen business schools at master's level and PhD level that are getting super well-trained quants, right? Super well-trained quants. So now there's enough analytical capability to go around, so it's not just the guys doing the research for the products. It's who's going to buy the products. So those guys are just as sophisticated as we are, obviously. So, yeah, it's really changed.
So, and one of the other things that when you were starting DFA was figuring out how to distribute, get the product to market. And so you turned to developing. One of the big changes in the industry has been the development of the independent registered investment advisor network. But that's been a key aspect to what DFA is.
Well, right off the top of my head, we manage about $600 billion. I think, 450. So more than three quarters of it is to fee-only advisors. Well, when we started that in 1988, there wasn't any such thing as a fee-only advisor. I mean, Dan Wheeler, we were talking about Dan Wheeler earlier. I mean, we found some guys who were interested in training CPAs and other people interested in the market to actually deal with this kind of stuff. And lo and behold, they became fee-only advisors. I mean, the network of fee-only advisors that Dimensional has today is 5,000.
And it's still just a small fraction of the marketplace.
And the marketplace must be 50.
So
you know more about that than I do.
Well, I'm in it, but yeah.
Thirty years ago there was nothing, so it's all completely changed.
And because of the roots that you started with on the institutional side is how you started.
Yep.
You've had a requirement of advisors joining in that they work well with your institutional clients, so we're not trading in and out of your.
Yeah, I mean we got to be careful about. The immiscibility of the institutional business on the one hand, and the family advisor business on the other. That can't be regarded as a zero sum game. So if these guys lose, these guys win, and vice versa, right? That doesn't work at all. So you got to be very careful about how you're interfacing with respect to the two sets of players in the market. Now, mind you, the whole place has gotten so much more sophisticated that, I mean, it's hard for me now to tell where one begins and the other one ends.
But by and large, the community of advisors is consistent with what you have, you know, created with the data-driven, evidence-based kind of approach, right, and understanding that. That's been a key.
Right.
And it's really distinct from, if you go to industry group meetings, there's a dramatic difference between the two cultures.
Right.
So we've talked a lot about the whole investment world, but you've moved on in doing, you're focused now on some other areas now. And Denise, when she introduced us, talked about your work with Scripps and what you're doing at the farm. You want to talk about what's behind that and where you're going with that?
Well, this is Pandora's box, I can tell you that. And it's, and in one word, it's called energy. And the problem with, let me give you a couple of examples. The problem with energy is we human beings have developed a lifestyle predicated on oxidizing fossil fuels. So when you oxidize a ton of coal, for example, which is the least desirable of the fossil fuels, by the way, but it's kind of easier to think about maybe. So oxidize a ton of coal, you get 2.8 tons of CO2. What's the social cost of carbon? In other words, what does the culture as a whole have to absorb in terms of adversity when you dump a ton of coal into the atmosphere? University of Chicago has a big project, so does Stanford, to measure that effect. And my guess, by the way, just sitting here right now, this is just me, is that's going to turn out to be around $200 a ton. So now you've got a ton of coal, which costs $80, and you're creating 2.8 tons of CO2, which costs $200. That's $560, and you're paying $80 for a ton of coal. You're accounting for the $80, and you haven't accounted for the $560. You've just thrown out the baby with the washwater. You follow that?
Yeah.
The waste is manifold times more important than the input cost. So when you ignore the waste, you basically have ignored the whole damn thing. Well, the economics of fossil fuels is all predicated on that implicit assumption. Waste is an externality in the minds of economists, energy economists. Oops. How much CO2 do we have in the atmosphere? How about a trillion tons? A trillion tons of CO2 is the mass equivalent of 500 billion automobiles. We have 1.2 billion automobiles on planet Earth today. So in round numbers, the amount of mass of CO2 in the atmosphere is 500 times the mass of all of the automobiles taken together that we have on planet Earth. Oops. What's it cost to take 100 parts per million of CO2 and split the C from the O? Without going through all the details, I can tell you the number is between $200 and $400 trillion. Oops. How are you going to get rid of CO2 other than split the C from the O, which is what we, in the first, what did we do in the first place? We combined the O with the C, right? We got a lot of energy, but we forgot what the cost of this stuff is. We have enough CO2 in the atmosphere right now to absolutely 100% guarantee global warming. The only question is in which decade and how much damage it's going to do. That's the problem. So the problem is massive. So what's the solution? Renewables. And they're coming online gangbusters because they're economic. We have a renewable microgrid at the farm in Sonoma, and it's, our marginal cost of juice is zero, and our marginal carbon footprint is zero. Where are we getting this juice? From the sun. what's the cost of a photon? So you run a photon through a fuel cell, in effect, because you create hydrogen from water. What's the marginal cost of water? Zero. What's the marginal cost of hydrogen? Zero. You run it through a fuel cell, and you get about 85% efficient energy. What's the waste when you run hydrogen through a fuel cell? Zero. So we have a solution. We just have to get there. It's going to take a massive transformation, right? And we're going to have to get started, and we're going to have to get started in a hurry. But the beauty of it is it's economic. When things are economic, they happen. We don't need any great goddoom to shout orders to the crowd. The crowd knows what to do when it's economic, right? That relieves 100 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere that we're going to have to do something with. Who's going to pay for that? My view is the only answer is a carbon tax, where the government is restricted to using the proceeds from the carbon tax to sequester CO2. Can't use it to expand the government. You have to use it to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. I mean, if you removed about 20 parts per million for 5 years, you'd remove 100 parts per million. By the way, if you remove 10 parts per million from the atmosphere, what's going to happen to the gas, the CO2 gas that's estranged in the ocean? It's going to outgas, right? So we've dumped actually 2 trillion tons of CO2 in the atmosphere. Just 1 trillion remains there, and the other trillion is in the ocean and in the land. There's an equilibrium between those things. You pull some out of the atmosphere, it's going to come out. And the question is how much and how fast. So the long and the short of it is, if you pull some out of the atmosphere, somebody's going to have to pay for that. I think it should be paid for those by the people who put it there in the first place, right? And that doesn't necessarily mean just those in the room, but those who came before us and those who are going to come after us. So it's the classic tragedy of the commons that we got to solve by, I don't think there's no way to solve it except to have a tax. But as I say, a tax that's used exclusively to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. So, giving the government more tax money is dangerous. Yeah. But the long and the short of it is I don't see any other solution.
Mag, as we're starting to run to our time limit, let me try to, so this is really, you believe, as we've talked, is one of the areas that is be considered in the investing going forward and all. But so let me ask you the last couple of questions, then we'll open up for questions. From all the work that you've done, what are the most important aspects of the work you've done? What are you most proud of?
Stand up, Morgan.
His son.
You think I'm kidding? Well, Dimensional is a phenomenal place, and it's got a phenomenal amount of brain power.
In many ways, that's your team that you actually started at Wells. Many of those are still there. I mean, together.
It really started at Wells, and of course, it's permeated all kinds of places in investment management. I mean, you're a perfectly good example of what I'm talking about. At Scripps Institution of Oceanography, where I've been on the advisory board now for going on whatever it is, 19 years. I never really knew much about energy before I got involved in Scripps. Scripps is involved in oceanography, climate or atmospheric science, and geoscience. And I'd never really studied any of those things. I studied all kinds of science, but none of those three things. Scripps has $200 million a year in spend. It's almost all coming from the federal government. It's about 400 projects. Projects are created by principal investigators. And they have some hypothesis, and they go get some agency to put up the money for it, or at least some of it. There was a time when the University of California put up some money for it, but that's pretty much gone. So it's pretty much funded by the federal government in about 30 or 40 different agencies. Well, there's a lot of very important research going on. At Woods Hole is the same thing in Massachusetts. It's about the same size institution, a couple of hundred million in annual spend. And the dominant focus in both places, if you want it one word, is energy. Understanding it, where to get it, what to do with it, what the waste consequences are. But there's just no doubt in my mind that hydrogen is the answer to our primary use of energy. And I'm not talking about propelling a submarine, by the way. I'm not too sure I care much about submarines, but the long and the short of it is, but vehicles, house heating, industrial energy sourcing. Hydrogen has got twice the energy density of gasoline. You can run it through. Fuel cells are in the 80% efficient category. An internal combustion engine is 20% efficient, maybe. So it's got four times the efficiency from a potential energy in to useful energy out point of view. It's just by far the most desirable thing I can say about the future is hydrogen.
Thanks. I think she's trying
to get it. Thank you, Rick and Mac. Maybe you'll be able to stay around in case people have some questions or would like to talk. But unfortunately, we've come to the end of the program. Mac and Rick, do you have any email or phone number you'd like to give to the listening audience in case they'd like to reach you?
People can reach me at my phone number is area 650-325-5890, and my email is rrabin, that's spelled 2 R's, A-Y-B-I-N, at lifetimecapitalgroup.com.
Our thanks to Mac McQuinn and Rick Rabin for their comments here today. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting on the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 116th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
I misunderstood our time. I thought we had another 15 minutes.
That's fine, yeah.